I'd like to share with you something that I came to understand more deeply when I traveled in India. Many of you might already be familiar with it, perhaps. It is a gesture with a spoken word that in India is a greeting, a farewell, and an expression of gratitude, all of those things. So here is the gesture, and the word is namaste. Namaste means the divinity that is in me bows to the divinity in you. And one of the most important aspects of namaste is that when it is given, it must be returned, the word and the gesture. It is always mutual. Namaste.
Namaste.
In January of 2008, I had the privilege of traveling to India for 3 weeks with students and faculty from Lancaster Theological Seminary, where I was in my third year of study. The trip was called the Cross-Cultural Seminar, and it was required for all Master of Divinity students. You had to go if you wanted to get your MDiv, so I was forced to go to India. And the purpose of that trip is for the students. This is a United Church of Christ seminary, a Christian seminary is where I went. And the purpose of the trip is for students to experience another culture than their own, but especially it's to experience Christianity in another cultural setting. Because guess what? Christianity in other places in the world does not resemble in many ways Christianity as practiced here. So we visited 5 cities all over India in 3 weeks, staying mostly at Christian seminaries and other types of Christian institutions. And our host seminaries and churches were all part of the Church of South India, which is the major Christian Protestant denomination in southern India. There's a Church of North India and a Church of South India, and it's really a combined faith, which includes almost all of the different Protestant groups, Lutheran, Methodist, Baptist, and so on. For me, one of the highlights of the trip was our 3-day homestay with Church of South India ministers. Our homestays took place at the very southernmost tip of India in the district of Kanyakumari. And the slide on the left is the whole map of India. And if you look down in the southwest corner, you see the state of Tamil Nadu. And then if you look on the map on the right, which is southern India, you'll see Kanyakumari right down there at the very, very, very end, the very southern tip of India. So the ministers who took us into their homes for the weekend had been given very strict instructions. We were not supposed to be treated as tourists, but to be included as colleagues in their ministries for the weekend. Let me tell you, we were terrified about doing this, absolutely dreading going off with people that we didn't know into their homes and their churches for the weekend. So, on a Friday afternoon in the small city of Nagercoil, the seat of the Bishop of Kanyakumari, we were parceled out 2 by 2 and scattered across the district. My roommate Rachel and I were assigned to the Reverend Maher in the nearby town of Kolachal. And on the way to his house, we stopped to pick up his wife, Dea Shaju, who was coming from work, and their 18-month-old baby, Johannan, who was in daycare. Dea Shaju was a C++ programming instructor at a nearby college. We arrived at the church and parsonage well after dark, and Dea Shaju and Maher immediately set about making dinner. And then after eating, we could finally relax and chat. Well, my roommate Rachel and I, we had to give the Reverend Maher the bad news right out of the gate. He had gotten the oddities of the trip. Rachel is the seminary's faculty secretary, not a student. Therefore, she was excused from any ministry activities, which left them for me. And I, though a student, of course, I am not a Christian. And our Unitarian Universalist faith is not a Christian faith. though many of us still remain Christians. Maher, thank heavens, took it all in stride. He attended a very, very ultra-liberal seminary in Bengaluru up in Karnataka, where we had spent a week, and I was lucky that I got Reverend Maher. That evening, Maher asked me in detail about my beliefs and theology. He had never heard of Unitarian Universalism and was super interested in the faith and the practice. And there was much I said that he absolutely affirmed and appreciated. And he spoke to me about being a Christian minister in South India and what were the most important aspects of his religious life and service as a minister. Saturday morning, Maher and I made home visits in Maher's neighborhood, as he often does. We visited Protestants, Muslims, Roman Catholics, and Hindus, mostly families who were middle class or else poor and struggling to survive. And I saw that Maher was held in great esteem by all of the people of all faiths in his neighborhood. Maher asked me if I would pray with and bless people who requested it, and so I did. Most of the people we met did want a prayer or blessing from me. So I prayed with, blessed, and anointed men, women, and children of all faiths. And none of these folks understood English, nor did Maher translate. Hindu, Protestant, Muslim, and Catholic, they accepted me and what I offered with openness and graciousness. It did not seem to matter that I wasn't speaking in a language they understood, nor that I did not understand them. And with the people of this neighborhood, I really experienced transcendent moments of connection and grace and humility. On Sunday evening, after I preached in Maher's church that morning, where he translated, I'd say several sentences, and he would translate that automatically into the local language spoken. It's also called Tamil. So we did the sermon together, paragraph by paragraph. And that evening, Sunday evening, we were hosted for a farewell dinner by the bishop at his residence in Nagercoil. And he stopped to chat briefly with each of us. He told me that about 2 years before, very near to Maher's church, there had been sectarian violence between Hindus and Christians at a Hindu temple. Over 20 people had been killed. And interfaith tensions still were high in the area. Yet I did not witness that tension in Maher's neighborhood in the way that he related to his interfaith neighbors and how they related to him and to me. Over and over again, as our group attended lectures and presentations at Christian seminaries, we heard one main message from the Indian theologians who taught us. And this message was of the importance of true religious pluralism. Religious pluralism was presented to us as essential to the practice of Christianity in India. And this message of religious pluralism being central to the practice of Christianity was so radical that a few of my Christian trip mates could not accept it. So, what is the religious experience, the religious pluralism I experienced in India, and why should it matter to us as Unitarian Universalists? Well, there are three paths that relations between religions can take: exclusivism, inclusivism, and pluralism. Religious exclusivism is the assertion that one's own religion is the only true and valid way to understand and relate to what is real and what is ultimate. Those who are non-believers are in some way condemned in this life or perhaps in an afterlife. For strong religious exclusivists, the only legitimate form of shared religious activity between people of different faiths is conversion. And for religious exclusivists, their faith really is like a stone, rigid and complete. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be changed. And like a stone, it can be used to wound people. The practice of religious exclusivism is a major cause of the worldwide violence, conflict, and oppression that is justified on religious grounds. Religious inclusivism is the belief that there may be value in other religious traditions, but that value remains limited. Inclusivists may believe that other religions offer some form of salvation, however that might be defined in any faith, but this salvation remains that of the inclusivist faith. This is true even if others have never heard of the inclusivist faith. So, that is, for religious inclusivists, people of other faiths are really members of the inclusivist faith, but just don't know it yet. And for religious inclusivists, their religion remains the only true one and is considered the fulfillment of all other religions. So it's the up arrow, and all the others are present, but definitely the down arrow. Now, religious inclusivism is not as potentially dangerous or destructive as exclusivism, but it is patronizing and presumptuous. Inclusivism remains profoundly disrespectful of other people's religious traditions, and certainly exclusivism and inclusivism have often been weapons of colonialism in many faiths, in many countries around the world. Religious pluralism asserts that all faiths, all paths of the spirit, are equally true and equally valid. So it is only through the practice of a true religious pluralism that healthy relationships and a full religious understanding are possible between people of different religious traditions. I also distinguish between what I call true and shallow pluralism. Religious pluralism is often misunderstood as affirming a type of shallow relativism. This type of shallow relativism says all religions are essentially the same and at their heart present the same set of values. Perhaps you've heard that metaphor of the various religions being like different paths up the same mountain. Well, I'm a pagan, humanist-flavored, Buddhist-inspired, Unitarian Universalist who loves Jesus. And I'm here to tell you that not only are our paths different, we are not on the same mountain. There are deep and real differences and contradictions among various faiths. Differences among their beliefs, their practices, their values, and their aims. And to minimize these differences is to reduce all religions to some lowest common denominator that does not really exist. Now, a great deal of interfaith dialogue, sadly, does not move beyond emphasizing the similarities among faiths. And like, that's not a bad thing to do, to seek out those commonalities. But it avoids the truly challenging work of understanding and respecting the differences, those differences that can make us so uncomfortable. At United Theological College in Bengaluru, capital of the state of Karnataka, Protestant theologian, the Reverend Dr. Casey Abraham, spoke to us about religious pluralism. And he said that true religious pluralism requires two key behaviors. First, people must be willing to critique their own religious beliefs, values, and practices, to hold them up to the light of critical reflection and examination. Second, people must be willing to learn from other religious traditions about what is real and ultimate for that faith, and be open to learning what that might mean for their own beliefs. So, true religious pluralism is about a willingness to be transformed in your own self, in your own deepest held values, beliefs, and practices by engaging deeply with the values, beliefs, and practices of people of other religions. Religious pluralists believe that it is only through encounters with the religious other that our own faith can truly develop. What is the value of our sense of ultimate reality if it cannot endure the challenge or questions we get through meeting the religious lives of others? How can our relationships with ourselves, all beings, and the ultimate grow and flourish in isolation? If there is no genuine encounter with the religious other, religion becomes like a stone. So whether you conceive of what is real and what is ultimate as goddess, as the universe, as the collective force of the human spirit, or as something else altogether, you must know your conception is limited. None of us can know the totality of what is real and what is ultimate. There is always more to learn. There is always awe and reverence for the unknown spirit of life. There is always the mystery. And this mystery is necessary. It is so necessary in our human spiritual lives. Often, the moment we think we have it figured out forever can be a very dangerous moment for any of us. So I came back from India much stronger and more committed in my Unitarian Universalism. I was in my 50s. I didn't expect that, and I didn't think it was possible. How could I possibly care more about this faith than I already did? But it did. This didn't happen because I went to India and practiced religious pluralism. It happened because people in India practiced religious pluralism with me. They were willing unconditionally to have me pray with them, preach to them, bless them, and worship with them. They were willing to teach and share what they believed in a non-defensive way and to learn what I believed. The Christians I encountered in India modeled religious pluralism for me and with me. Their great gift to me was their willingness to be a mirror in which I could see my own faith reflected back to me through their religious understanding. This was supreme grace coming from their deep hospitality and what they believe their Christianity demands of them. So why should this notion of true religious pluralism matter to us as Unitarian Universalists? Because we Unitarian Universalists manage some aspects of the interreligious life very well. We affirm other religions socially and politically. We are champions of religious tolerance and freedom worldwide. This is wonderful. It is important. It is necessary. But as the logicians say, it is necessary but not sufficient for true religious pluralism. As a faith without a religious creed or doctrine, we Unitarian Universalists have an incredible opportunity to transform ourselves through the practice of religious pluralism right in our own congregation. All too often, though, we can remain reluctant or unwilling to engage with people of different religious beliefs and values, even right here. And we are such a rich mosaic of beliefs and practices. It's as if we sometimes have a don't ask, don't tell policy about sharing our religious beliefs and values with one another. I've been seeing this for 45 years. And to avoid this kind of sharing builds a cage that limits our own growth and our love and respect for one another. And our discomfort with that sharing also limits how we relate to each other and the wider world. Living true religious pluralism, building our rich mosaic of the spirit right here together, means saying yes to the hard and exciting work of knowing each other as we wish to be fully known, as our most whole and complete selves. And this happens through the sharing of our truths, our values, and our sense of what is ultimate and real in our lives. The practice of religious pluralism is necessary to develop the deep, genuine respect and love that is necessary for community within and community beyond our walls. The respect and love that are called for in our first principle and all our covenants with one another. It is through the practice of true religious pluralism that we have the greatest chance of ending the worldwide violence and oppression that comes from the practice of religious exclusivism. Your spiritual homework in the coming weeks, if you choose, is to ask someone in this congregation, maybe even someone you think that you know very well, about their personal religious beliefs, values, and practices, however they might define those. They may not use the word religious. Then listen with all your heart to what that person has to say. Please seek for that deepest understanding. Reflect on what you hear from the other person. And then please ask yourself, what did I learn about myself and my own beliefs, values, and practices from this encounter? In the reading this morning, we were asked to bring strange things, to bring new things, to let very old things come into our hands. And these are the strange and the new and the very old things we encounter in religious others. If we walk carefully, walk mindfully, walk fearlessly into the religious lives of others, we will indeed be always coming home. And this homecoming will be to our true selves. This homecoming will be to a truer sense of this community, our community as a Unitarian Universalist. This homecoming will be to a fuller understanding of how we can heal the world, how we can be a truly welcoming and healing people. Namaste.
Namaste.